Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Smith, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Harriera Balayan, Director of the Carter Center's Conflict Resolution Program. The Carter Center was founded in 1982 by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and his wife, Rosalynn, in partnership with Emory University to advance peace and health worldwide. A non-governmental organization, the center has helped to improve life for people in more than 80 countries by resolving conflicts and advancing democracy, human rights, and economic opportunity. Harriera Balayan leads the Carter Center's conflict resolution efforts around the world, particularly focusing on such areas as Israeli-Palestine, where the center supports a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Liberia, to advance access to justice in a post-war setting, paying special attention to the needs of marginalized populations, in Syria, where the center is working toward a political solution to the catastrophic war by exploring governance and constitutional reform options, and in Europe and the U.S. to prevent the rise of violent extremism. Mr. Balayan joined the Carter Center in 2008 as director of the Conflict Resolution Program. He also served as an adjunct professor at Emory University Law School from 2008 to 2017. Teaching an advanced international negotiations seminar. Since 1991, Mr. Balayan has worked in the Balkans, Eastern Europe, the independent states emerging from the former Soviet Union, the Middle East, and Africa. He previously served in the United Nations and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, as well as non-governmental organizations, including the International Crisis Group. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from Golden Gate University in San Francisco. Today, Mr. Balayan will give us an assessment of how ongoing dialogue can significantly reduce violent confrontation and aid desperate populations in the world. Please welcome Harriera Balayan.
Okay. Thank you very much, George. Thanks, George Dobbins, for organizing this. These lights are brutal, really. I can't see a thing, but perhaps just as well, because I won't see my son here sitting making faces at me. So that'll be great. Thank you for helping me. George Dobbins, thanks so much for organizing this. And Skip Rose, thanks very much for moderating the discussion later after my short presentation, I hope. I'm really grateful to the Commonwealth Club for inviting me here. This used to be my town. I used to practice law just a block away behind this building and went, as George said, went to school down the street on Mission Street, Golden Gate University. And I was expecting lots of friends of mine to be here. I hope they are. Very nice to see them too, hopefully after the event, the discussions. What I plan to do is to touch on what we do at the Carter Center very briefly, what the Carter Center is very briefly, put the work we do in conflict resolution and peace building in the global context of conflicts, share with you how we do conflict resolution. What does it mean to do conflict resolution or peace building activities, and what are the principles that we use in our work, the guiding principles that we've learned from President Carter and we use in our work on a daily basis. And finally, some thoughts before I conclude and move into the question and answer period. I mean, obviously, in a 30-minute, maximum 30-minute presentation, I can only touch on some of the issues, some of the topics, the really broad scope of the kind of work we do without entering too deep into the subjects. But hopefully, during the question and answer period, we'll have a chance to dig deeper into some of the issues that I'll be discussing. The Carter Center wages peace, fights disease, and builds hope. When I talk about building peace, we're talking about what we call positive peace, not just the absence of conflict, not just the absence of war, but positive peace that can sustain the absence of war and conflict. Fighting disease is the simplest thing, the most comprehensible thing that we do at the Carter Center, most tangible thing that we do at the Carter Center, and much easier to raise funds for. When we talk about waging peace to governments and individuals, that's the harder part because it is so intangible what we try to do. And then building hope is even more intangible than waging peace. Very hard to explain and make people understand what it is we do. At the end of the day, the Carter Center is a non-governmental organization, albeit founded by a former U.S. President. We are an independent, U.S.-based, but an international non-governmental organization. Our work is all in the international scene. We don't work on U.S. Issues. Our funding comes from governments, intergovernmental organizations, foundations, interested individuals, people donating to us anywhere from $10 to much, much larger generous contributions. Our budget, annual budget, is about $90 million per year. Two-thirds of it devoted to our public health work, one-third, less than one-third, actually, to the peace work, including conflict resolution. We have about 200 staff in Atlanta and hundreds more in the countries where we work. We work in the poorest, most troubled areas around the world, in three continents, basically, Americas, Africa, and Asia. We don't do any work. We used to do some work in Europe as well, in the Balkans and the former Soviet Union, but we have stopped doing that for some time, much before I joined, and I've been there for 10 years. If I said war is the greatest violation of human rights, I don't think I will be exaggerating. Perhaps some of my friends who are much better experts in human rights than I am would argue with me. But I think this is something that gives us pause and gives us reason to think. Why am I saying that? Since 1945, between 1945 and 2009, 103 countries have been affected by wars, 59 of which protracted and relapsed wars. And since 2000, and in 2007, 28 countries, states, were directly affected by wars, 13 of them protracted wars. And we'll discuss some of them in terms of the work we do in those countries. The trend since the fall of the Soviet Union, since the end of the Cold War, has been more internal conflicts than interstate conflicts. And when we talk about intrastate, internal conflicts, civil wars, always supported by external actors. And the more actors there are, both within the country and external interveners, the more difficult the conflicts are to solve, and the longer, the more protracted they are. So that's a trend that we've seen since 1990-1991, the fall of the end of the Cold War. Another trend that we've seen, and this is the most troubling trend, is that nothing seems to be sacred anymore, even during wartime. Whereas before, attacks on medical facilities were side products. They were incidental issues. Now they seem to be the target. Attacks on civilians are the targets. Sexual violence is weaponized in the wars that we've seen. And the number of victims have proliferated, huge number of victims. Syria alone, 500,000 people plus killed. Actually, we stopped counting. And for the past year and a half now, we've been saying over 500,000 people were killed in Syria. Well, God knows, nobody knows really what the numbers are. And most significantly, international humanitarian law, the laws of war, seem to have gone on the side. No one respects them anymore, whether it's superpowers or internal conflict fighters. What is driving this war? Many, many, many causes, many reasons for the wars we've seen in the last decades. Here are some of the causes of the war. The most important of which, I think, is the identity wars, whether it's narrowly conceived self-determination, territorial disputes, sectarian disputes, violent extremism and countering violent extremism, anti-globalism. Those are some of the factors. Organized crime. War has been criminalized. Organized crime is a big factor contributing to the wars we've seen. Competition for natural resources, energy, water, grazing land, another contributing factor. And something that ought to really concern us is the rushed democratization attempts that we've tried in the last decades, whether it's in Africa, in the Arab world, and elsewhere. Regime change, externally driven regime change, have been some of the more significant factors for the wars we've seen. Iraq, Libya, Syria, and in Libya we tried something called the R2P, Responsibility to Protect the Doctrine, that was brought to the surface with huge effort by international colleagues working in the same field, Gareth Evans of the International Crisis Group and others. And then in Libya, we abused that principle. The international community went into Libya under the guise of the responsibility to protect, and very quickly we turned into a regime change. And that was the end, the death of responsibility to protect doctrine. And of course, poor governance is a major cause of the conflicts we've seen. What do we do? What do we mean by conflict resolution? Is it mediation we're talking about? Yes, sometimes in the very, very rare cases we get to the point of a mediation, bringing parties together around a table and concocting and working out an agreement. But that's a very small part of our work. Most of the time, we are really facilitating, building bridges between various parties in informal setting. We're trying to come up with ideas to overcome obstacles that the parties are not able to come together and have a discussion. We're trying to provide a back channel track to facility workshops or other similar discussions where if parties to a war engage in a discussion, it really has very little political cost for them. Whereas if they went to the UN or some capital, the Washington or EU in Brussels, brought the parties together for a discussion in a formal setting, everything said, everything done, everything signed, everything uttered in those settings have consequences, political consequences to the parties. So the parties are far less likely to explore ideas in a formal setting than in the informal setting that we provide to them with the Carter Center in various countries, including at the Carter Center in Atlanta. Conflict resolution is advocacy as well. I'll give you one example. From the very beginning of the Syrian conflict, this country, the U.S., Washington, Europe, and many other countries immediately, the first weeks, wrote off Assad and said, Assad must go, and that became the slogan. It was really a wishful thinking rather than a policy. And we tried to advocate that this is leading us into a dead end. You know, wishful thinking cannot substitute policy. Let's look at what a possible transition could look like, and perhaps all parties in Syria could see a stake for themselves in the transition if we can explain it, come up with some creative ideas on how power can be shared rather than one side or the other winning. So these are some of the things we do in conflict resolution. I discussed already the track two, that's the back channel confidential discussions we have. Track one and a half is when we bring officials into the back channel discussions have them provide them a forum for dialogue with each other. And track one is the formal setting in which the discussions take place. And we don't do that. That's the UN countries or regional organizations, etc. We are, in the work we do, we do it with the highest level leaders, of course, with the intergovernmental organizations such as the UN, African Union, and some other organizations, OAS and others, but also we work with governments at the very highest level, heads of states, presidents, prime ministers, etc. We meet with them frequently and try to find solutions. Lower level officials, civil society representatives, rebels, of course, terrorists, one size, don't forget, one size terrorist is the other size liberation fighter always. And we work with grassroots level, grassroots organization all over the world. A prime example is in Liberia, where we work with traditional leaders in the hamlets back in the bushes to try and bring justice to the very poor places, the corners of the country. And this work is done by senior staff in the Carter Center like myself and my colleagues. President Carter is still very much involved, but he's slowing down his involvement to basically transfer the lead to staff. But also we use other retired leaders. John Kerry headed one of our observation missions recently, and we've had a number of former heads of states head our missions in the field. So I talked about earlier the principles that we use that have come down from President Carter's experience in doing negotiations and mediation and conflict resolution since the 70s, early 70s. And they're listed there. You can read it on the screen. We talk to everyone. We take risks. We reject zero-sum outcomes. We have to have a unique contribution. We don't duplicate the work of others, doing effectively something. One size does not fit all. I'll come to each one of those things in the next few minutes. One needs patience, persistence, and humility to do conflict resolution, mediation, and we must understand the complexities of every single conflict, and the conflicts are very, very more and more complex as we go forward. One example is Syria. We've been involved in Syria since before the civil war started in 2011, and we've redoubled our effort in Syria since 2011 when the war started. We've used the contacts both on the government side at the highest level, from Assad to other ministers to the opposition who were in jail when we used to work for them, advocate their release, and later when the revolution started, they were out, and we were working with them, both armed and civilian opposition inside the country as well as outside the country. As I said earlier, the West wrote off Assad very early on, prematurely, and we tried to change the conversation from when Assad must go to what a transition could look like through back-channel discussions that we organized between various segments of Syrian society and government officials, with an amber light from the government, would participate in our discussions. One of the things we advocated is that, and we continue to advocate, is that when the West started talking about Assad must go, they also cut their relations and all dialogue and engagement with the Syrian government. And for 7 years now, this is the 8 years, we're in a war for 8 years now, the eighth year now, we've been trying to urge the international community, in particular the West, to re-engage with the regime. Any conflict resolution effort starts with engagement, with dialogue. Okay? No matter how ugly the person you're talking to is, no matter how bloody the hands of the person you're talking to is, you've got to talk to them. You've got to engage with them. And unfortunately, we have not succeeded in this. We talk with the government as well as the opposition and all other sides, as well as the international sponsors, but we have not been able to convince the West to re-engage with the Assad regime. You cannot end the war if you're only talking with one side. It's just impossible. Imagine. I mean, it's unimaginable that one can do that. We at the Carter Center engage with everyone. And this has a cost. This has a cost because it's not always popular to talk with terrorists, to talk to the Hamases of the world, to talk to Bashir in Sudan. It's not popular. We get a lot of flack for it. But you've got to talk to them. Somebody has to talk with everyone. Talking is one thing, but also the other side has to talk to us. We have not been able to engage with Daesh or ISIS. They're on their way out. But the ideology of Daesh is going to continue in one form or another, under another name. We have not been able to engage with them because they're not interested. And frankly, I would like to keep my head where it is rather than on the ground. So if someone could guarantee somehow that it's okay, we can talk to them, we would do it. The same goes for Al-Qaeda. We have not been able to talk to them because they're not interested. So the other side has to be interested. As I said, this is not very popular, has consequences. And in all of these talks, international law is our guiding principle. We stay within international law. We're principled, however, we're also practical. And here comes a dilemma we have in almost every single case in which we're involved. Do you go to a dictator and say to the dictator, you've killed thousands of people, how dare you? Now let's sit down and let's have a talk how to end this war. It doesn't work that way. Okay? So we try to divide among ourselves, among various silos or colleagues that do different kind of work at the Carter Center, how we approach it. And often when we're engaged in negotiations, in conflict resolution negotiations, our priority is to stop the conflict and then move into working on the human rights issues, governance issues, and transitional justice issues. This is not also very popular with our human rights colleagues, but most of them understand why we do that. It's a question of sequencing. Why did I say war is the greatest violation of human rights? If nothing else, this picture ought to speak 1,000 words, really. This is a suburb of Damascus, about 5 kilometers from the center of the city, a refugee camp formerly inhabited by Palestinians, but during the war, every internally displaced person came and grew the population to over 500,000 people in here, and the place was pounded on a daily basis. And this is a crowd waiting for humanitarian handouts for their survival. We take risks. As I said earlier, talking to terrorists and dictators is not very popular, but we take risks. But the greatest risk we take is that in probably 90, 95, 99% of cases that we work on, failure is more common than success. So we have to be prepared to fail in our work. And that's okay. President Carter always tells us, it's okay, you try. And if we fail, we fail. That's fine. And Israel-Palestine is one example in which we've been stubbornly trying to pursue the two-state solution and also reconciliation among the Palestinian factions feuding with each other since the beginnings of 2000. We haven't made much headway, but we continue. We persist. We fail, but we come back and continue. But frankly, there are times when one runs out of idea or in despair, throws the hand. We can't afford it. At night, maybe, but not during the day when we're working on the cases. We try to promote win-win outcomes. If one side prevails on the other side and treats the other side as the victors usually do, not very generously, then we're sowing the seeds of the next conflict already in that country. And I'm afraid what we're seeing in Syria is that. With the Assad side winning the war against the opposition, with no consideration for any concessions, I'm afraid we're going to be seeing a repetition of this country, of this conflict in Syria not long from now. People are tired, are sick and tired of the war, may go underground, may hide their weapons now, but they're going to come back. You can rest assured continue the fighting.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
We try not to duplicate the work of others. When you have too many cooks in the kitchen, obviously the meal gets spoiled, and it's the same in conflict resolution. There are so many conflict resolution organizations out there trying to compete with each other for the funds, the donor funds, in particular government and intergovernmental organization funds, that they try to get involved and step on each other's toes, and it really spoils the meal. And the negotiations. It creates forum shopping opportunities that are never good for conflict resolution. However, if an intergovernmental organization or another government is doing the track one process, the formal negotiation, it doesn't mean that there's no room for the track two actors like us at the Carter Center, serious track two actors. As I said earlier, this is where, in the track two process, is where opponents can test ideas with each other, and then if it starts making sense, take it to the track one level. One example is Syria, where we do this. Another example is in Sudan, where the AU is running, former President Mbeki is running the formal negotiation process between the government of Sudan and the rebels in Darfur and in the Nuba Mountain areas. But we are providing back-channel discussions between the U.S. government and the Khartoum government, and the result of that was a ceasefire that was agreed to back in January 2017. In exchange, the parties in Sudan agreed to a ceasefire, in exchange for which the U.S. removed some of the sanctions, and we're now working on the rest of the sanctions and national national reconciliation government. We're nowhere near it, but that's the thing. That's what we're working on. One size does not fit all, obvious. But often it is possible in our work to bring examples of how other peoples have resolved their conflicts to a very particularly difficult conflict, to show them, not to duplicate what was done elsewhere, but to show them how it's possible to generate new ideas and come up with ways in which one can resolve the conflict. And we've done this in Syria and a number of other places, where we bring colleagues, former ministers, former negotiators from South Africa, from the Northern Ireland case, from Tunisia and from Philippines, to share their experience on strategy rather than the actual what they did with the parties that are having difficulties in getting to solutions. This is another obvious one: patience, persistence, and humility in our work. And the gentleman on the picture, Stefan de Mistura, the UN mediator for Syria, is really an unbelievable example of patience, persistence, and humility. He's been trying this for 5 years now, 4 or 5 years now, without results, really without results, and he's still pushing, he's still trying. It's obvious to say that we really know less than the protagonists in a given conflict, so we really have to be humble, and President Carter is another our example of humility, persistence, and patience in the kind of work we do. We have to understand the complexities of the conflict. Two-sided conflict is really a luxury. Doesn't hardly exist anymore. It's multi-party, internally complicated by external actors. And the picture you see on the screen is something we did in Syria based on social media. We acquired a very powerful software tool given to us free to document, based on social media, no confidential information, just on social media, the proliferation of the opposition armed groups in Syria, the relationships and hierarchical relationships between them, and their relationships with outside funders, and what trends we could see from this. It was really an amazing. We had an intern at the time in 2012 who started digging into it and trying to find amazing information. As soon as his internship ended 3 months later, I hired the guy. Now he's heading a department of 10 people just doing documenting conflicts through the methodology that we created. So we have to understand the complexities of conflict. We have to understand the history, the cultural background. We have to be sensitive culturally. And let me just make a few concluding comments and conclude so that you can ask questions and we can get perhaps a little deeper in some of these issues. We talked about at the start of my talk about this trend of nothing being sacred anymore. What is causing this? Some people say, and frankly, I don't believe that. That's nonsense. It's just an oversimplification, that violence in everyday life today, even in entertainment, in games that young people play, including my son, violence is ever-present. Violence is glorified. Maybe that's 0.0, I don't know what percent causation one can find in there. But the causation is much more complicated, much more complex than a single cause. It's poor or failed governance, it's human rights violations, it's income inequality, it's restricted information, it's corruption, it's rejection of other, the rejection of the other in general, whether the other is a minority, national, linguistic minority, religious minority, sectarian minority, the exclusion of women from decision-making processes in some countries still today. Many, many causes for this. Frankly, I don't have the answer as to why we are seeing this proliferation of conflicts and the enormity of the conflicts we've been seeing around us. But let me stop here, and perhaps we could explore that subject in the question and answer period. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Harir Balian, Director of the Carter Center's Conflict Resolution Program. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and a supporter of the Carter Center. It's time now for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions, and keep them coming, please. And so let's begin. Ready?
Please.
Okay.
Shoot.
What is the role of democracy in creating conflict resolutions?
Well, as I said earlier, just in my concluding comments, the absence, the failure, the absence of democracy, the absence, the failure of governance is one of the root causes of the conflicts we're seeing. And that's historically true. It's nothing really new. That goes back decades and decades, where governments have failed and democracy has failed. The governments have failed, have taken liberties that perhaps under democratic systems they would not be able to take.
Would you say that non-democratic states could produce stability in the same way democracy can?
No, I'm going to commit a heresy. Sometimes they can, yes.
Okay.
But whether that's sustainable is another issue.
Right.
In certain situations, in some circumstances, perhaps the absence of ability to counter a government can produce a certain kind of stability, but that is not a sustainable stability. Sooner or later, it catches up, really. Repression produces a certain kind of stability, but whether that's a desirable stability, that's another issue. By throwing people in jail, the dissenters in jail, yes, for a while it produces stability, but that's not the kind of stability that can be sustained on a long stretch of time.
This questioner wants to know, in what ways do the Carter Center's efforts differ from those of other U.S. NGOs?
Number of ways. One of the big difference that we have from other non-governmental organizations is the fact that we have two sides in the house, the public health and the peace side. And I'll give you one example to illustrate how the nexus of these two activities is something that sets us apart from other organizations. Back in the 90s, President Carter produced something called the Guinea Worm ceasefire in Sudan. As you know, at the time, Sudan was much larger. South Sudan was part of it, and there was a civil war raging. And President Carter came up with this, and we were doing Guinea worm eradication in Sudan, the largest Sudan at the time. But we couldn't really pursue our work in the conflict zones, and we were failing, basically. President Carter came up with this idea of a Guinea worm ceasefire to start talking with the warring factions that why don't you stop fighting in a given locality, in a given small town, village, for just a week. Give us a chance to go in and bring our effort to eradicate Guinea worm, which is really affecting your, debilitating your communities in this area. And then we do our work, we go in a week or two time, then you can continue your war. But this became contagious. And when the villagers started seeing the warring factions, when the villagers started seeing the results of a one-week ceasefire, they started putting pressure on both sides to continue the ceasefire. And the village next door, why not us? And it spread into what became the Guinea worm ceasefire. I think it was in 95 or 96, I can't remember the date now.
Wonderful.
We're trying to do the same thing now in Mali.
Explain a little more how that's happening.
This is still a very embryonic project. We're just starting. We've done a six-month study with an expert on Mali, expert on health, and an expert on peace-building activities, gone into areas and talked with the warring factions to see if it would be possible to stop the fighting for a short period of time, a month, for us not only to do the Guinea worm inspections and continue the work on Guinea worm in places where we've had no access because of the violence and the conflict, but also bring other health benefits to the village. It has not been tested yet. As I said, this is a pilot project. We're just starting now, and we're hoping, we're really, really hopeful that it's gonna take root. And in modest ways, in small places at first, it will take effect and have an impact on the health. And we're hoping that we can produce the same result that in the 90s President Carter's was produced, this time without President Carter's involvement.
Good.
At the staff level. Yeah.
In your remarks, you mentioned that it's difficult to even begin negotiations or discussions for conflict resolution if you can't bring all the parties to the table. If you have an obstinate one that says absolutely not, what is left in your arsenal of weapons that will allow them to see the light of coming to the table.
Thank you for catching that. I should have said all the significant parties. There will always be outliers. You will not be able to bring the Al-Qaeda to a negotiating table, at least not under the current conditions in Syria. And, well, maybe I'll be surprised too, and they'll come to the table too. But there will always be spoilers in a conflict. If you bring the majority, the significant parties to the table to start discussion, to start a dialogue, then I think you're on your way. You haven't solved the problem yet, but you're on your way to start solving the problem.
When you have these negotiations around the table, is it held in the country where the conflict is agreeing, or do you have to go to a neighboring country that's not involved in the conflict?
In some countries, we do it in the country. In Mali, for example, we do it there. Liberia, we work in Liberia. There's no conflict in Liberia today. But in Mali, there's still very severe, serious conflict taking place in the center and the north of the country. We do it there in the country, the discussions. In Mali, we've taken on a role that is very unique for the Carter Center, a groundbreaking new role, which is a formal role in the peace agreement implementation process. We've taken on the role of the independent observer in the peace process in Mali, reporting to the Comité de Suivi, the committee of governments that are following up on the peace implementation, peace agreement implementation, and the Security Council. We did it last week in New York. In other places, we're not able to go into the country. Syria is an example where we just cannot go in the country. Right. So we bring people to the neighboring countries, either in Turkey or in Lebanon, or because in one or the other country, not everyone can come, we go to Europe. And some governments have been extremely generous with us in helping us facilitate bringing some very questionable people to their country. People who admit traveling with fake passports, yet one country, which shall remain unnamed, has facilitated the arrival of these people into the country. They go pick them up from the airplane, bring them to the meeting rooms, and then take them back to the airplane directly. So we do both ways. Depends on the situation.
Another questioner asks, in what ways do human rights shape conflict resolution today compared to the Cold War era?
Difficult question. I don't know if it's different, and I would really appreciate comments from the audience on that. I don't know if you do that, the direct comments from the audience here. I shouldn't have opened my mouth on that. frankly, I don't think it was different. It's different from the Cold War. I mean, human rights, well, perhaps. In the Cold War era, human rights were far less part of the discourse, part of the discussion, until, frankly, President Carter brought it into governance. The whole notion of human rights has to be part of the foreign affairs. And following that was we had the whole process with the former Soviet Union of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, CSCE, which then became the OSCE, which brought human rights to the forefront of international discourse and international negotiations on moving forward in the process. Now, I guess it's much more an acceptable part of the discussions in conflict resolution, negotiations, etc. Yeah.
For the benefit of all of us here and also on the radio and watching us on television, what would you say the status of conflict resolution efforts are with respect to Syria?
What status? Oof, we're at a dead end. I'm afraid we're at a dead end still. The opposition, as much as there is an opposition, and the government of Syria have not sat down in the same room to talk with each other, except in one instance in Astana where they're discussing, they have discussed ceasefire arrangements. The latest iteration of where we're heading on the Syria negotiations is what was proposed in January in a meeting in Sochi, Russia, under the sponsorship of Russia, Turkey, and Iran, bringing all the parties together in a big, under a big tent, in a national dialogue process, an agreement. A statement was basically rammed down their throat without their agreement that a committee will be formed to discuss constitutional reform and governance reform in Syria. And we're still working on forming that constitutional committee, we meaning the international community, not the Carter Center. But the Carter Center pioneered the work on constitutional work since 2013, when everyone told us that, why are you working on constitution? I mean, there's a shooting war going on. Who cares about the constitution? But when the official process entered the constitutional discussions, we were ready. We had options. We had governance options. We've done the homework. We had trained people. We had done capacity building with our Syrian colleagues from both sides on having discussions and strategy on constitutions. So they're all part of this now constitutional committee. It's a long answer to your question, but we still have a very long way to go. Frankly, until and unless the six countries waging war in Syria today, US, Russia, Iran, Turkey, Lebanon through Hezbollah, and Israel, can decide what it is they want out of Syrian conflict and how they want this conflict to end, the Syrians themselves will never be able to stop the war because they're the ones stirring the pot right now, we, including us, the U.S.
And in that discussion of those six countries, where does the government of Syria stand?
Intransigent. Intransigent in giving up or changing as little, as minimal as possible. They're the victors. In their view, they're winning. They're not thinking about tomorrow as to what those vanquished would do tomorrow, saving their fight for another day. That's the role they're playing. Okay. And of course, I mean, there have been enormous violations of human rights and humanitarian laws during the course of this conflict committed in principle by the government of Syria, but also by many other sides as well. And the international community, let's not forget that.
Yes. Yeah. Another area, what steps must be made during the installation of new governments to mitigate other groups from exploiting power vacuums like in the case of Al-Qaeda?
I'll go back to your first question, what role for democracy in conflict resolution? You know, elections are one form of resolving the conflict, political conflicts. If parties in a country do not have the ability to solve their conflicts, whatever the conflict may be, through the democratic process, then what is left to them but to pick up arms? And once they pick up arms, the state starts failing, and that opens the door, the Pandora's box, for everyone from outside to come in, including violent extremists of all color. And I hate to use the term Islamist violence or violent extremists, just violent extremists of all color, all shades, using religion, one religion or another, as a tool for gaining power.
This one you may want to duck, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What impact do the policies and actions of the current administration in our country have on the attainment of your mission?
Okay, let me start from previous administrations, plural. Okay, we have not been saints. in the conflicts that we talked about this evening.
Yes.
Okay, Syria, Yemen, Libya, Afghanistan, and others. We've made way too many wrong moves to promote the conflicts rather than solve conflicts. The current administration and the Obama administration has not been exempt from that either, I'm sorry to say. But the current administration has brought it in. We are a bipartisan organization. I shouldn't be saying this, but we are seeing a new low level in terms of what this country is doing. And I'll give one example, Israel-Palestine, where the embassy has been moved unilaterally, the U.S. embassy has been moved unilaterally to Jerusalem, preordaining the outcome of what happens to Jerusalem, basically, and giving a blank check to Israel to move towards the one-state solution that Israel understands.
Okay.
And undermine the two-state solution.
Thank you. If back-channel discussions are more successful than conventional methods, why don't we use them more often?
They're used very frequently. I mean, there's room for both. It's not one is more effective than the others. I mean, you need the formal channels. There's no question about it for agreements to have the weight of states and intergovernmental organizations behind them, and in particular a Security Council imprimatur either under Chapter 6 or Chapter 7 behind them. But as I said, there is room for back-channel discussions as well to prepare the ground, to prepare ideas, to kick around ideas, to come up with ideas out of the box, and then for the parties to explore these ideas without the political consequences of the formal process and then take them to the formal process once they're comfortable with the process. And sometimes these ideas are in fact developed in the formal process.
Yep.
So there's room for both. It's not one a substitute for the other.
How does Russia's current support for Assad in Syria hinder U.S. efforts to alleviate that conflict?
U.S. is not trying to alleviate that conflict, I'm afraid. We have not been trying to alleviate that conflict. We have aggravated that conflict from day one of the Syrian civil war. Day one of the civil war, we encouraged the opposition to go all the way, including the West in general, the U.S. and Europe. The West encouraged the opposition to go all the way and grab power without realizing that Assad is not Mubarak and Syria is not Egypt or some of the other countries where very quick changes were possible by popular uprisings. We knew it. We know Syria. We've been working in Syria. We know Syria inside out, and we knew that was not going to happen in Syria, and it was going to be a bloody civil war if we continued encouraging them. So that's what we did. We didn't resolve conflict, and to this day, we are in Syria supporting the Kurds to their detriment, I'm afraid, to their detriment, because it is in the better interest of the Syrian Kurds to negotiate with Damascus some sort of an autonomy arrangement rather than rely on the U.S., which has always been a fickle supporter of the Kurds, including also in Iraq. We're not solving problems in Syria, I'm afraid.
Okay. From your activities with the United Nations, both inside and outside, what do you think about our country withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Commission?
Terrible. Terrible. Terrible idea.
Put a little more meat on the bones.
I mean, it's an awful idea, and I think this is the second time we've done it. Rita, please correct me if I'm wrong. This is the second time we've done it. I mean, if we don't agree with the majority, the overwhelming majority of the international community, what do? We withdraw instead of looking at ourselves and say, maybe we're doing something wrong. Okay, if the overwhelming majority of the international community in the Human Rights Council thinks in a certain way on a given issue, we know better, and in a fit we withdraw. Really, is that a mature behavior? Behavior of a mature country with 200, 300 almost years history? I'm sorry, it's a disaster what we've done.
What impact, if any, does the media have with their coverage on your job and your efforts?
Mostly they don't cover because we stay below the radar. We try to stay below the radar. Most of the work we do is really quiet, confidential, as I said, under the radar. Very frequent, I mean, I rarely talk to the media because too frequently the media takes something you say, distorts it, and one party or the other in a given conflict on which you made a comment gets upset with you and closes the door on you, and that's the end of your years of effort, possibly. So we try to stay away from the media.
Two-part question. What makes a successful conflict negotiator, and as a nonpartisan NGO, do you have any tips for President Trump in this area?
Oh, my gosh. Let me duck that question. I think we talked about this already.
Okay. I can see you're a skillful negotiator. Can you give us a story about the most difficult challenge you've had in recent months in your activities with the Carter Center?
You know, the work we do is so difficult in terms of trying to produce results, but also in terms of the subjects with which we work. Often my colleagues at the center go through dozens, hundreds of YouTube video segments of Al-Qaeda or Daesh or ISIS propaganda. And those are, if any one of you have seen any, if you've seen a single one of those videos, they're shocking. I mean, you've seen some of the videos on television, actually, beheading of journalists and Americans and et cetera. My colleagues and us, we look at these things on a daily basis. Not just because we're perverts, but because we try to understand what it is they're trying to do. We try to understand their recruitment strategy, for example. How do they appeal to young people? How do they appeal to women? How do they appeal to an immigrant in the Paris suburbs or the Brussels suburbs? Or how do they work with young people who have no future in the slums of Tunis or Casablanca? We have to understand this in order for us to design the project that we have preventing violent extremism and the recruitment of violent extremist organizations. And this takes a toll on us. You know, when you're doing this on and on and over again, it really takes a toll of us. On us. It's very difficult to do the work we do. And then the disappointments over and over again with the work we do and the results. We sometimes get something very close to producing results after years, months of work, and something happens. Somebody says something inappropriate and boom, it's gone. And we start over again. It takes a toll. It's difficult.
We've come to that point in our evening presentation where we have one remaining question. And I hope to end it on a high note.
First, I was just going to say.
How did you become involved with the Carter Center? And what do you think has been the Carter Center's greatest achievement since you've been there?
A colleague from election observations, I was working on election observations 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, in Ivory Coast, where a colleague called me just out of the blue because he knew my the work that I'd done in other organizations and said, "If would you be interested in joining the Carter Center?" That was David Carroll. And I said, interesting, yes, I've always been sort of intrigued by what you folks do. And next thing I know, a few months later, I was having an interview with President and Mrs. Carter, and the first question he asked me is, "How would you resolve the Middle East conflicts?" I said, "Oh my God, what did I get into?" But I must have said something interesting that convinced him, and he hired
me.
He said, "You've got the job." And what was the second part of your question?
The second one, what do you feel,
the greatest
since you've been there, the significant, most significant achievement?
I think what we were able to do in Sudan, the beginnings of a peace process, by extending a very temporary, tenuous ceasefires that they were entering into up until January 2017, before President Obama left office, convincing the acting as a go-between between U.S. government and Khartoum, and convincing the U.S. The Khartoum government to go for a six-month ceasefire rather than the very tenuous small ceasefires that they were doing, and in exchange for that, getting a lot of sanctions relief, which then started an off-again peace process, which I think, God willing, will get to something very soon. I think this is an achievement that one of my colleagues in the center was able to, in my department, was able to produce with the advice of President Carter.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our thanks to Harayer Balian, Director of the Carter Center's Conflict Resolution Program. We also thank everyone here, as well as our audience on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Skip Rhodes, and now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is concluded.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Good show.